Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast totally unsuited to political commentating, but makes up for it with vigour, independence and caustic wit. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
Now, we are noted for our independence, not so caustic wit, but I'll tell you who is known for caustic wit, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Toby Young.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That well-known raconteur Boris Johnson, when he's not writing columns about bum boys, he says that Toby Young has got a caustic wit, so therefore surely he's the best person to think about students.
Obviously, a caustic wit is the only real experience you need to be a member of the university's regulator board.
It's also why Steve's going to be foreign secretary in the next reshuffle. There is a Friday Fizz on the website notenoughchampagne.com which links to some of the tweets that Toby Young has said, which are quite controversial, almost more controversial than him advocating eugenics, which is interesting. We can't read out those tweets, listeners, because we're now on Spotify!
Woo!
And Spotify don't want us to have any explicit content, so we can't really read out tweets about what Toby Young has been saying about women and their intimate parts. Oh, I've probably broken that rule already. It is a new year, 2018. It's the third year in which we've done this podcast. And will 2018 be as crazy as 2016 or 2017?
Probably.
Okay, is that just because of Trump?
Yeah.
Listeners who don't know, we are in a nuclear bunker and have been since Trump won the election. And we were making tentative plans to exit the bunker over the Christmas period. And then Trump joked about the size of his nuclear button and we shelved those plans. And they've been put at the bottom of a very big drawer. And maybe in 2020 we'll get out of here. But I think we're stuck here for now with tinned food. We are instead going to start this new year as we started last new year. And that is by thinking about the resolutions that all the main parties should have in 2018. Right, Steve, let's start with Theresa May and the Conservatives. Now, you wrote a piece on the website outlining what you thought the Tories should do. What should the Tories' New Year's resolutions be?
So, the full list is building an actual agenda, finding ways that they can work with the opposition on selected issues, and stop making everything about Brexit.
Right, let's go through them one by one and why none of them are going to happen. I mean, I agree with you, they should happen, but they're not going to happen. So, first one, building an agenda.
Ever since the general election and the loss of the Conservative majority and the rejection, therefore, of their manifesto, the Tories have been floundering in terms of domestic policies in an awful lot of ways. They don't have anything to really get their teeth into. As a result, not a lot's been happening. Now, granted, yes, they've been focusing a lot on Brexit, but they need to be able to make a point that the next general election, whenever that may be, that they have done some positive things in Britain, not just dealt with Brexit. And as such, they need to, early on in this year, actually get an agenda in order so that they can move forward with it and actually get some policy wins under their belt. There were rumours before Christmas that Theresa May was going to potentially create a new government department for infrastructure and transport or something like that. Probably would end up being a rebranding of the Department for Transport in some form, and maybe kicking out Chris Grayling and bringing in somebody new.
Please can they kick out Chris Grayling, because he's actually useless.
But the problem is that actually kind of having this agenda means they need and making these kind of promises potentially on areas like transport or infrastructure, which are vastly needed. Don't get me wrong, if the government does come through with this, then fair play to them. But it's going to cost a lot of money, and they will need to break out of their austerity paradigm quite substantially in order to make it happen.
I think you're right. It does need to happen. Theresa May, when she made her first speech as Prime Minister, was saying that she outlined the fact that she wanted to try and tackle some of the inequalities that there are in Britain and put forward a progressive conservative agenda, which was very nice. However, building the agenda stuff isn't going to happen, partly because, as Andrew Adonis has said in his interviews, which we linked to in the Fizz, the government is completely paralysed by Brexit and all the government bandwidth is talking about that, as is parliamentary time, as we'll talk about next week. there is so much government business on Brexit, there's not going to be much time for anything else. And in fact, there are very few bills in the Queen's speech last year on anything other than Brexit. The other problem is, the person who would have actually sketched out May's radical agenda and reframed conservatism for the 21st century, Nick Timothy, well, his brain, but more importantly, his beard, it's not in government anymore. He resigned after the June election because he pissed everyone off. So there isn't anyone really doing the intellectual legwork there. And that is a massive problem for them. I mean, one of the things you haven't mentioned, but I think Theresa May needs to do as a matter of course, is to get some new advisors. Nick Timothy is still an influential columnist, so maybe he's doing some informal advice. Gavin Barwell is a very well-regarded chief of staff. Gavin Williamson, the assassin-faced baby who was chief whip and now is defence secretary. But because he's a defence secretary, he's not able to provide that advice. So there's a nice bit in Ed Balls' memoir where obviously he was an advisor to Gordon Brown for years, then became an MP and a minister. Well, what Ed Balls was saying is, as soon as you're a minister, Gordon Brown was trying to call him about advice on number 10 stuff and other policy stuff. And Ed Balls would say, well, look, I've got a department to run. I haven't got time to advise you. So I don't think he'll be around to give Theresa May great advice like promote me and make me a cabinet minister.
It's a very fair comment on the unlikelihood of this actually happening. But I do think actually what you've mentioned there about the bandwidth of Parliament focusing only having the capacity to deal with these big issues like Brexit and nothing really else actually moves me quite nicely onto to the second resolution, though, which is finding ways to work with the opposition on selected issues. There are a number of not necessarily big issues, but nonetheless very important issues which it is possible for the government to make some headway on in various forms. Let's start as an example, domestic violence, and the fact that women's shelters don't have the necessary funding. No one is going to object to a government that says we are going to increase funding for women's shelters. And, you know, the actual kind of the money that we'd be looking at there, it wouldn't, for funding those sorts of things, wouldn't necessarily be massive, talking in the millions rather than the billions. And if the government is able to build an agenda around these sorts of issues, there are a number of Labour and opposition MPs who will happily work with the government when they are doing things that are sensible. Jess Phillips would happily work with the government on domestic violence issues. There was a video I saw over the Christmas period, which I think it was John Ashworth had shared, discussing alcoholism and the children of alcoholics and the support that they have. John Ashworth himself, child of his dad is an alcoholic, gave a very moving speech about his relationship with his dad and the importance of looking after them, you know, the sorts of things you would expect. So I think the minister was Nicola Blackwood, made a very moving, and was literally in tears by the end of it because of all the various tales that she'd heard at that moment in time. And that issue, you would easily be able to build consensus.
I think I'm right in saying that stuff has happened, hasn't
it?
Exactly. Policies moved
exactly.
Forward.
So policy has been moved forward on that. And it's the sort of thing where the Tories would probably gain an awful lot of kudos with the British public at large if they said, these things are really, really important. They've often been overlooked because we're too busy arguing about big issues. So we're going to move forward with this little stuff and we're going to stand together. Everybody wins, really. So working with select members of the opposition can lead to a very positive outcome for the government.
It can, but I think you're right in that it will be mainly on small issues. I'm not saying it's insignificant issues, definitely not, but it is on small issues rather than on the big picture. And I think it is only with select opposition politicians. I don't think they're going to reach out. Well, actually, Theresa May did reach out to Jeremy Corbyn after the election, and Jeremy Corbyn sent her a copy of Labour's manifesto and said, implement that. And he said, well, yes, 1-0 to you, Jeremy. But I think the other thing about it being select backbenchers is the Tories need to work out what their attack lines and dividing lines are going to be for the next election with Labour. And then we can assume that part of that is going to try and portray him as some sort of mad cap-wearing Marxist or take us back to the 1970s. Now, you can't keep up that facade if you're trying to work with him on select policy. Like, the people who Theresa May really should be working with are the Tory backbenchers. And actually, they have been working with them. They have backed down and made changes to universal credit because of pressure put on them by MPs like Heidi Allen, MPs like Dominic Grieve, Nicky Morgan. So I don't think they're going to work a lot with the opposition as well. I think they might do on one or two bills, but I cannot see it happening on anything very substantial.
The thing is, from my view, I think the government needs to just have a record of doing something that's actually going to make a positive impact. Because if you go into the next election and you can't say, this is how we've made Britain better, you can make all the cases you want about Brexit or whatever, but if you can't point to some solid things that you have delivered, then you're not going to get a hearing. They might be small, but those smaller things, you know, if you do enough of them, they add up. And they can form the basis of actually, you know, a reasonable campaign to get yourself re-elected next time round. Again, I think you're right. The likelihood that they would do this is limited. There needs to be a genuine commitment to make it work. But again, it's something that they should look at doing.
Number three, stop making everything about Brexit. Well, everything is about Brexit, Steve.
I know. But here's the thing. The government is doing little bits and pieces here and there, which aren't Brexit related. And an example of this was the government made some changes to the law about, which would have made it, he basically was a crackdown on puppy farmers, so that everybody can rest easier in their beds, knowing that the government and Britain as a whole is being nice to cute little animals. You know, it's not a bad policy. It's not going to change the world, but it's not
it will for the puppies, Steve.
I know. It should have been the lead story, really, for what they were doing on that day when it happened. But the problem was, on the exact same day that new story broke, it was the same day that they announced the blue passports were coming back. I'm not saying necessarily that the blue passports are a bad idea. I don't really care either way. I don't care what colour they are. I don't get why people care what colour they are. But clearly people do care, so the government would be foolish to not try and exploit that in some way, given that those people are their voters and their core vote. But you can do it a lot more subtly than having a government minister make the announcement and make that overshadow the popular policy.
I think what's happening with the blue passport stuff, and if you do read the Friday Fizz, and if you don't, then you really should, a certain section of the Conservative Party seems to think that changing electoral fortunes lie in creating a culture war around issues surrounding Brexit. So the blue passports is a good example of that. The appointment of Toby Young to the Office for Students is another good example of that. Chris Heaton-Harris creating a sort of pound shop McCarthyism in universities and asking who lectures on Brexit is an example of that. Joe Johnson over Christmas saying universities should try and should be havens of free speech and should be fined if they allow people to be no platformed, which isn't a university thing, that's a student union thing, is an example of that. And I think in terms of stop making everything about Brexit, well, they might do that, but what they'll do instead is just start a new culture war.
But that's still not Brexit. And yeah, I think that's a flawed strategy for them, given when you look at where the voters they lost came from. They were the Liberal Tories, they were swing voters who voted Remain. You know, that culture war stuff isn't going to go down with it, so it's a flawed strategy. But it's at least a strategy that's not just yammering on about the details of Brexit day in, day out. And that, I think, is a significant issue that they are going to have. As you said, it is most of their bandwidth, but they need to find ways to talk about other issues.
What resolutions should Labour have this year?
So the first one, I'm going to seemingly annoy probably every single wing of the Labour Party in the way that I have a habit of doing. The first resolution is to actually get radical and be vocal about it. So let me explain.
But Steve, that manifesto, it was so radical, and it was literally the best manifesto that's ever been written in the history of time.
So I wrote a piece on the website about railway renationalisation and about how it's not actually a particularly radical policy in and of itself. Really, in terms of actual impact, being progressive, it's really limited. It's basically a middle class subsidy for commuters. On its own, you know, that is a popular policy, but I would say it isn't radical, or at least it's certainly not radical enough. In my railway piece, I argued for building out a wider transport strategy. We're, you know, investing in infrastructure, radical kind of expansion of rail electrification up north, investment in buses, you know, all kind of different forms of public transport, which are going to actually have a direct return on an investment for the government in terms of economic growth. We're not seeing that currently. And you can see this kind of this issue where you've got this headline grabbing policy, and then nothing around it to actually make it a properly radical agenda in other areas as well. So the so-called National Education Service is another example of this. So it seems to have been created to basically make the scrapping tuition fees sound more radical than it is. I like the notion behind a National Education Service. I don't know what the hell it entails, though. And again, you need to be able to build that out over time, but you should at least by now be able to say these are the core principles or something like that. With the NHS, the core principle can be described in one sentence, basically. Access to healthcare that's free at the point of need. And we're not making though that kind of messaging available currently. We're not talking about other areas necessarily very publicly about what we can do in education. And as a result of that, you've just got a headline-grabbing policy and nothing else, and those policies themselves aren't going to actually revolutionise the lives for Britain as a whole. They'll win votes, so by all means, have them in there. I'm not complaining about them being in there as policies in the manifesto, but they aren't going to change people's fortunes in this country.
The National Education Service at the moment reminds me a little bit of Ed Miliband's One Nation Labour, which that's a brilliant
notion,
soundbite, yeah, but you need then things to hang off it and everything needs to go in. And in a way, it didn't really happen under Ed. It became one of those things like the promise of Britain. Or this old pre-distribution, say. Someone read a fancy new book by an American consultant, or someone in the office had a big brainwave, and then everyone forgot about it and went on to the next thing.
Yeah.
From what I know about what's happening with Labour in Parliament, what the message of Jeremy has been since the election has basically that we need to fireproof the manifesto, that it needs to be put ready for government. So I think this actually might happen. I think the other reason why it's the policy thing which needs to be nailed down for Labour is a very good way of answering the charge that Jeremy Corbyn would take Britain back to the 70s. It has to be all about, no, we need radical change. This is radical change that is new. And a lot of it is where the British public is. So a year ago, we were talking about Corbyn rebranding himself as a left-wing Trump. Well, this year, he's talked about Labour becoming a party of the centre in terms which are more Blair than Trump, and talking about being a new mainstream. Now, he's right in that a lot of the policies like renationalising the railways, they are popular with the public, but it's then you need more as well. You need more than just a shopping list of policies.
Exactly. And that's why I think actually building out those agendas now, or starting to at least, and actually being vocal about it can help. Because as you said, one of the issues that Ed Miliband had was they kept on fleeting between different messages, changing them to lots of different things, which meant none of it ever cut through unless you were in the Westminster bubble already.
Second resolution.
So the second one is to mobilise momentum for the local elections that are happening in May and get out the vote. These local elections are going to be an interesting case study for the Labour movement currently. An awful lot of the success that Jeremy Corbyn's Labour had in the general election last year was down to increased levels of activism, some getting out the youth vote in various places, and just generally running a ground campaign which the Conservatives could not match. Labour's membership is something in around the 500,000 mark these days, I think. The Conservatives, it's estimated, are now down to 70,000. But not all of those members are activists. And as a result, you need to work to get them out there, out on the doorstep, and actually knocking on doors, delivering leaflets, and talking to people. Momentum can be a very, very good tool to make that happen. But momentum needs to be organised enough to actually make it happen. And if the leadership, Labour leadership, actually have a word with John Landsman and say, we need a national strategy for momentum to get your members out on the doorstep into these target areas. And if you can get those momentum members out there, you will not only make it much more likely that you'll win seats in the local elections. You'll set yourself up quite much more effectively to getting people out and about during the general election, whenever that is as well. And on top of that, if you can get Momentum people out there and you're vocal again about the fact that Momentum has gotten out there and local parties can see that these Momentum people are out there, when Momentum people start running for positions on committees and or whatever, you're going to get less kickback. You're going to see less of a fuss made because they're putting in the hours, they're putting in the time, they're actually demonstrating that they're not interested in just running for an office because they think, oh, it's this thing is overrun by Blairites. They're running for an office because they want to make a difference. And that's, so there's multiple benefits to mobilising Momentum.
I don't know enough about Momentum to know if that mobilisation does need to be, you know, John Lansman unleashes hell.
Yeah.
Or a lot of it in the general election was very bottom up. So it was things like having tools like My Nearest Marginal,
yeah,
or having car sharing, or having apps on which you could do phone banking.
Absolutely, but all of those things still require a centralised organisation in some form to make that happen.
I think it's an important point as well to say that it can be a way of trying to erase a lot of the bad blood that built up over the last couple of years in the Labour Party. As we've moved to the local elections, there's been various deselection rows over Momentum, which, if I'm honest, have been massively overblown.
Yep.
There have been very, very few. The biggest example of which is in Haringey, but Haringey is a very, very special case. So I think if there is a great turnout, well, from all the Labour grand game, but especially Momentum, then there'll be lots of gains. Everyone will be very happy.
Mm-hmm.
And we can stop worrying until the next civil war.
Yep.
Okay, third resolution then.
Prepare for a snap general election.
I don't want another one.
So I don't actually think there is a likelihood currently that there will be a snap general election this year, next year, maybe the year after. But, you know, you need to have a plan in place just in case there is.
Mm-hmm.
We are in very unstable times. The government has no majority. They are riven with differences on their own side over the major issue of the day, Brexit. And even on other policy areas, there's an awful lot of things that they're not necessarily going to be able to get unity around. And as such, the chances of another, the government falling and another snap election having to happen in some capacity, it's not null. So you need to have a plan in place for it. Just make sure that you have taken that manifesto and fireproofed it and got it costed properly, because the only reason Labour got away with it last time was because the Tories didn't do it at all. And they didn't provide any costings. And some of the costings in the Labour manifesto were not brilliant. Like, literally, Private Eye magazine was quoted as one of the costings.
Personally, I would chain Theresa May to her desk and forbid her from going on any walking holidays for about the next 2 or 3 years. They need to have a plan in the back pocket. They need to do the legwork for it. We can assume that the next election will be 2 or 3 years at least, rather than 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we should be prepping target seats. We should be sending activists there. Momentum has been sending activists to certain target seats of high-profile Tories. A lot of MPs will have spent the general election only campaigning in their own seat. Now, that can't be neglected, obviously, but Labour should have enough activists to be able to have their cake and eat it. So, yeah, I don't have any problem with that, apart from the fact that you're just talking that there might be a snap election. I don't even want to encourage that kind of talk. Let's move on to the Lib Dems. I suppose the resolution for the Dems is pretty similar to the
Everyone
Greens,
else.
The UKIP, and all of the minor parties. Regular listeners will know that there are several Vince Cables who masquerade as one Vince Cable, the Lib Dem leader. You've got the Social Democrat Vince Cable, the Orange Book of Vince Cable. You've got the chief economist for Shell, Vince Cable. You've got the Vince Cable who tries to see himself as a humble economist outside of party politics. You've got the Vince Cable that plots ruthlessly to try and become leader. Now you have the Vince Cable who's as Lib Dem leader.
Yeah, Vince hasn't really made much of a breakthrough for the Lib Dems yet. Now, granted, still relatively early days for his leadership, but he needs to find a way to break out of this, and he needs to find a raison d'etre for the party that's actually going to resonate with the public. And I think actually one of the issues Vince is going to have is actually that his own membership are going to potentially try and drag him in a direction which isn't going to help him. if you're sad like me and pay attention to party conferences and look at what various debates are and how those debates go, the Lib Dems is always fascinating. And they've already had some debates last year about how staunchly pro-EU they should be. The official position was basically, we will have a second referendum. And the other basically argument was, no, we shouldn't be entertaining this madness in any form. Let's just call the whole thing off. And you can easily see those sorts of policy debates going against the leadership.
It feels like both Clegg in 2010 and Farron in 2015 both made decisions that they hoped would pay off in the long run. So Clegg entered the coalition thinking he'd take a hit for taking the Tories into coalition, but would be rewarded with stable government, Lib Dem achievements, all that kind of thing. Whereas all he got out of it was a knighthood and he lost 40 MPs. And Farron took the view that the Lib Dems needed to, they could be the anti-Brexit party. And in 5 years' time, when the whole thing was a disaster, people would reward the Lib Dems for their farsightedness and vote for them. That may or may not be a very good strategy, but it certainly doesn't work if there's going to be an election the year afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it was far too early for that kind of message to kick in. It may even not really work as an issue in 4 years' time, but that's a different discussion. In June, people are more interested in trying to kick out the Tory party rather and vote for Labour, who would have a softer Brexit, rather than someone who would stop it altogether.
Unless you're an EU diehard in some capacity.
But that, as we talked about in our probably one of our first podcasts on EU identity, there are about seven people in Britain who would describe themselves as European, and we probably know three of them.
Yeah, essentially the issue that the Lib Dems have is that they don't have a core vote that's of any substantial size. It doesn't help that they're very, as a party, the Lib Dems are very nostalgic and they're constantly harking back to the olden days. Not necessarily in terms of it was better in this decade, but in the sense of they are constantly, constantly stuck in Charles Kennedy's shadow. Kennedy and the success that he had, it overshadows everything else they're doing, and they're trying to recreate that. You can guarantee that whatever area is being discussed, whether it be health, whether it be defence, you can find somebody who will say, you know what we should do? We should add a penny to income tax to pay for it. Because that's what Charles Kennedy promised on, I think it was education at the time. That's been come back for healthcare. It's come back time and time and time again as a notion of this is a radical policy which did well previously. I mean, even like Lib Dem MPs I like, such as Norman Lamb, have been doing that as well when talking about healthcare and mental health. And again, absolutely, you know, doing that would be a way to fund the NHS. So it's not a bad policy, but it's still the same policy you've basically had for decades at this point. And you're not moving forward and you're not coming up with new ideas, which unless you start doing that, you're stuck.
I think maybe very, very quickly, I think two things that won't help with that is, it's a point you made over the summer when we had a podcast on the Lib Dems, and you said that actually there are people who would call themselves liberal in all three main parties. And I think it's especially the case as the British public has got more socially liberal, both main parties have also got more socially liberal. That means that even if you self-describe as a liberal, you're not necessarily going to vote for the Liberal Democrats, and that is a problem. Yeah. And there's a point I thought of when Nick Clegg received his knighthood and people, then the debate about his role in the coalition comes up again. That actually, you had people like Owen Jones arguing that Clegg was the enabler of Brexit because he helped the Tory government pass austerity. I think actually, maybe with a bit of hindsight, what's more clear is that by abandoning the route that Charles Kennedy, the strategy that Charles Kennedy had, by decimating the reputation of the Lib Dems both amongst students and young voters and metropolitan liberal types, actually, Nick Clegg probably is more influential in paving the way for the electoral success of Corbynism.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree with that.
None of which really tells us what the parties will do in 2018. But we will keep you updated on, are the parties actually listening to us? They're probably not, but they might have thought them independently, maybe. But we'll have updates of that on the website notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Yep. Not Enough Champagne is too many characters for a Twitter handle, so instead it's @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is paperbackwriter.
Mine's @cinderradical.
James Crown designed our logo, and Dave Deppert is the man responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. We're back in the week talking about the movers and shakers of 2018, and then next Sunday we're talking about Brexit. It's the first time in 6 weeks, listeners. I'm really, really excited. Speak to you then.